Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon and good evening, and a huge welcome to our penultimate session in this mental health series, which in fact was Armstrong World's first ever mental health series. So we're absolutely thrilled to have Mr. Jeff McDonald with us today, keynote speaker, TEDx speaker, and mental health champion. Jeff is also co-founder of a wonderful charity called Minds at Work. They create the space where people, individuals can flourish and organizations can prosper, whilst also addressing the importance of well-being and opening the discussion around just mental ill health. So far this week, we've had input from Mental Health First Aid England, the City Mental Health Alliance, and members of our own CO community detailing their own journeys. And tomorrow we see Mental Health First Aid England return again, and this time Simon Blake OBE, their CEO, and he is addressing leading with authenticity and compassion. The aim of this week really is just to open conversations and share stories and highlight the wealth of resources that are actually out there, all with the purpose just to help break down the stigma that still surrounds mental ill health. Take your mental health seriously, recognize the triggers, but be aware when your mental health is compromised and address it. Whilst the majority of people are working from home to some extent, learn to draw the lines of demarcation of work and home life. A great suggestion yesterday was simply have a virtual commute. And by that, I mean, take the time to read a paper, go for a walk, get outside, some exercise. What would you normally be doing during your commuting hour? Don't get chained to your home desk. My name is Miriam Rooney. I am Chief of Staff and Global Client Director for Armstrong Wealth's International CEO Community. For those of you who may not be so familiar with us, Armstrong Wealth is an advisory firm to the Chief Operating Officers within financial services. We aim to empower the CEO community through the provision of thought leadership, share experience, and provide the platform to promote cross-industry dialogue. I've actually just recently joined Armstrong Wealth, coming from a transformation coaching background, where I worked almost exclusively with C-suite individuals. And I have seen absolutely at first hand what it means to ignore your mental health, the impact on your overall health, your family life, and beyond that are absolutely devastating. So I'm delighted we're hosting this timely series and highlighting mental health, particularly within financial services. The session today is going to be a slightly different format from our normal webinar due to the large number in attendance. So would you please ask your questions using the chat function throughout the session, and we'll answer as many as we possibly can in the Q&A at the end of the discussion. So I'm going to hand over to Mr. Jeff McDonald, TEDx speaker, co-founder of Minds at Work and mental health champion. A huge welcome, Jeff. Mental health and well-being.
Thank you, Miriam.
Wonderful to have you.
Can you see me okay? All good?
All good.
Okay. I'm in such a good mood, Miriam.
Yes. You need to tell us the story behind that.
The reason I'm in such a good mood is I have just got back home after being in South Africa for 5 months. And I completed my hotel isolation today. So 10 days in a hotel room. And I was released from the shackles of isolation at 6 o'clock this morning. And I've just got back to my home in a small little village called East Horsley, which is down in Surrey in the UK. Thank you for having me today. Wonderful to be able to engage with the group. And yeah, please feel free to stick some stuff on the chat, ask some questions, and we will create a bit of space at the end to answer those questions. I spent 25 years working for Unilever, culminating in the global head of HR for all of our marketing, all of our communications, and all of our sustainability efforts around the Unilever world. I was very, very fortunate to spend the last 5 years of my career archetyping the purpose of Unilever, redefining that sense of purpose for that organization, and then archetyping the transformation under the pupillage of Paul Polman. And at the end of 5 years of embedding that sense of purpose into Unilever and seeing the transformation of that organization and the impact that it had on our overall performance, I thought to myself, imagine if I were to leave the corporate world and go out into the world and live a life fueled by a deep, deep sense of purpose. And I think it was Mark Twain who once said, the two most important days in your life, what are they? And you know, as I speak around the world, to various audiences and I throw that question out, the most popular response that I get, 99.9% of the time, the response I get is that the two most important days in our life is the day we were born and the day we die. And, you know, I always reflect back on that response and I think to myself, what is it about the human species that we are so pessimistic about life? We are so pessimistic about life that we can't wait for the second most important day in our life, which is the day we die. So let me be born, stick me in an incubator, switch all the machines off, and let me die. And everyone will just celebrate. And of course, Twain didn't say that. He said the two most important days in our life is the day we were born, and as somebody put in the chat, the day we find out why we were born. Why? What is your why? What is your why? And often when I ask people that, their whys tend to be related to their work. I honestly believe that every single person who's joined me on this call today was born with a unique gift. A unique gift. And when you get out of the rat race, when you reflect on what are the things you truly care about, when you reflect on what people tell you you are so good at, that unique gift, once you've uncovered that gift, I honestly believe you can bring it to the world to make it a better place. I honestly believe every single person on this call has that unique gift. And mine is a very simple why. And that is to try and create workplaces all over the world where every single person in that workplace, and you know what? A kindergarten is a workplace. A university is a workplace. A regiment in the army is a workplace. Of course, Unilever, Procter, L'Oreal, HSBC, Barclays, BlackRock, they're workplaces. But I want us to have workplaces all over the world where every single person in that workplace feels that they genuinely, genuinely have the choice to just put their hand up and ask for some help if they are struggling with a common form of mental ill health. That could be depression. It could be anxiety. Or you may be bipolar. And I don't think that's a very noble purpose. I don't think it's a very lofty purpose. And let me tell you why. Because in every workplace, all over the world, if you had a common physical illness, the flu, glandular fever, an upset stomach, you'd put your hand up and ask for some help. Yet in the 21st century, in a century where we've put men and women on the moon and we brought them back safely, in a century when Elon Musk is going to probably stick us into Mars, we still have not only workplaces, we have members of family groups, friendship groups, where people feel embarrassed, ashamed, fearful of putting their hand up and asking for some help if they are struggling mentally or emotionally. How can that be? In the 21st century. In a century where, you know what? All of us on this call is mental, like me. We're all mental. We are all physical. We are all emotional. And some would say we're all spiritual. Yet, we can talk about our physical health and physical ill health, common forms, but we can't talk about our mental and emotional health, part of who we are. How can that be? And you might ask me, why am I so passionate about trying to create that kind of workplace? And I'm going to share a bit of a story with you today. And I'm going to put a warning up front that what I'm sharing with you today, some of it might feel raw. It might provoke some of you. And I would ask that if you feel provoked, if it does feel raw, please ask for some help. Go and talk to somebody. a loved one, somebody you trust. But have that conversation. And the story started back in 2008. I'll never forget the date. It was the 25th of January, 2008. And the reason I don't forget that date and never will is because on the 26th of January, my eldest daughter, Jennifer, was going to turn 13. So you can imagine how much excitement there was in our household on the evening of the 25th. Why? Because a young girl was going to go through a rite of passage at midnight. And there are people on this call who can truly resonate with how excited they were the day before they became a teenager, just like me. And at midnight, I got woken up with the most massive panic attack. Now, I had never experienced a panic attack in all my life. I don't think the words panic attack were part of my vocabulary. I don't think I'd even had a conversation ever in my life with anybody about a panic attack. The ends of my fingers are tingling. The ends of my toes are tingling. The bed sheets are wet with sweat. My heart is beating profusely, and I'm struggling to regulate my breathing. And because I'm so naive to this, I think I'm about to have a heart attack. And I bumped my wife, Debbie, and said, "Deb, you know what? I think I'm about to have a heart attack." And she asked me why, and I explained what was going on. And she said, "Get up, walk around the room. Why don't you take some deep breaths?" Which I did. Slowly, slowly, the levels of anxiety began to subside. I got back into bed, but I couldn't go back to sleep. I lay there, wide awake. And the three things that kept me awake: one, the adrenaline was pumping through my body. I was petrified that if I fell back to sleep, it might happen again. And I'm sure there's somebody, and there are people on this call with me today, who've experienced a panic attack. You would not wish it on your worst enemy, like me. Petrified. And the third reason I couldn't go back to sleep is I developed a capability to catastrophize over the most insignificant issues in my life. I would make a mountain out of molehills. Wow, did I get good at doing that. I remember having a sore on the inside of my mouth, getting up at about 3 a.m, going into the bathroom, interrogating the sore, getting back into bed, and convincing myself I had the beginnings of throat and mouth cancer. Convinced. And that I was going to die of cancer. Convinced. A little sore on the inside of my mouth was the beginnings of throat and mouth cancer. 7 o'clock the next morning, who comes running into our bedroom? Jennifer. We have a tradition at home. We put presents at the end of the bed. We open presents together as a family. Her little sister Anna comes running in after her. And all I can say to Debbie and to the two girls is, please, please leave me alone. On my daughter's 13th birthday, leave me alone. All I want to do is take the duvet, just pull it over my head, and for the life of me, I can't get myself out of bed. I cannot. I'm feeling paralyzed by the anxiety that I feel. Debbie takes the girls downstairs. Jen opens her presents. They go off to school. Debbie gets back at about 10 o'clock. Where am I? Still in bed. Now, I'm not the sort of guy who's in bed at 10 o'clock most mornings. I'm a typical South African. I love the outdoors. I love my sport. Go for a run of a morning, mountain bike ride, a swim. And here I am on my daughter's 13th birthday, struggling to swing my legs onto the side of the bed and just get out of bed. Debbie says, "What's wrong?" I said, "I don't know. I don't know." She said, "Jeff, you need to see somebody." "Who?" "A doctor. Go and see a doctor." "What? A doctor? I've got no aches. I've got no pains. I haven't got a temperature. I'm not feeling nauseous. I must go and see a doctor." At midday, I'm in a doctor's rooms. And he begins to ask me a bunch of questions. And you know, one of the early signs of what I was experiencing, one of the early signs, ladies and gentlemen, is that your levels of irritability go through the roof. I wish somebody had taught me that. The smallest little things that normally never irritate you just irritate you intensely. And here's this doctor starting some questions which begin to irritate me, like, "Tell me about your sleep." "Oh, over the last couple of weeks, I've struggled with my sleep. I wake up at about 2-3 in the morning. I can't go back to sleep. I lie there feeling anxious about stuff. Tell me about your diet. What is this all about? Ask me about my diet. Well, I can't eat breakfast. I can't eat lunch. Why? Because I feel too anxious. I've lost a lot of weight. What about the things you can read and can't read? I can't read a newspaper. Why? Anything sad in a newspaper would just trigger me. What about doing the things you love doing? Going for a ride with your mates. I haven't wanted to do that for about 3 or 4 weeks. I just haven't wanted to do the things I always normally love doing. What about socializing, being around other people? Please, I'm a gregarious individual. I don't want other people around me. No thanks. Have you had any suicidal thoughts? He asks me. Jeepers, what is this about? Suicidal thoughts? And you know, I had a suicidal thought. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to be honest. And so I said, yes, I have. He said, have you planned it? I said, no, I haven't planned it, but I know the method. And you know, being a male, it'll work. And he looked at me and he said, Jeff, you're ill. I said, excuse me, doctor, what am I ill with? You haven't taken my temperature. You haven't looked into my eyes. You haven't looked into my ears. You haven't looked down my throat. You haven't taken my blood pressure. You haven't listened to my chest with your stethoscope. What do you mean I'm ill? He said, you are suffering from anxiety-fueled depression. Me? Depression? Do you know what my understanding of the word depression was up until my daughter's 13th birthday? When Unilever first moved me to the UK in 98 to look after the Africa, Middle East, and Turkey business group from an HR point of view, I'd been living in the UK for about 2 years, and around about January time, people used to come to me and talk to me about a phenomenon called SAD. I used to say to them, okay, go on, what's that? They say, no, it's the abbreviation for seasonal affects disorder. I'd say, okay, go on, what is that? They'd say, no, it's the weather. It can influence your mood. I remember I used to think to myself, what a load of crap. The weather. Influence your man up, you snowflake. The weather. This arrogant South African who's grown up in the most beautiful weather in the world. Don't tell me the weather influences you. Just man up. Here I am, diagnosed with anxiety-fueled depression. As I leave the doctor's rooms that day, I make a decision, ladies and gentlemen, that saved my life. And you know, I wouldn't be here today, Miriam, if it hadn't been for this decision. I don't think I'd be alive. And the decision I made as I walked out the doctor's rooms is that I refuse to be burdened by the stigma that is associated with the illness I'd been diagnosed with. I refused. Now, I had something in my favor which allowed me to make that decision. There were a couple of things. The first thing in my favor was my personality. I wear my heart on my sleeve. What you see is what you get. Look me in the eye and you'll see if there's something wrong. I am not a Tiger Woods who can compartmentalize his feelings. I'm not somebody who's good at masking how I feel. What you see is what you get. Thank God for that personality. The second thing that was in my favor is that at the time that this happened to me, I was 20 years into a career with Unilever. I was doing a very senior HR job, looking after all of our home care division around the Unilever world from an HR point of view. I built the credibility I needed to build. I wasn't a graduate or a junior manager who was concerned about the next move in my career. And the third reason I was so lucky is at the time I was working for the head of the home care division, a guy called Keith Weed. And you know what? He had a compassionate relationship to mental ill health. Compassionate. He didn't see me as a snowflake. I was so, so lucky. I was so lucky. Cheap as I was lucky. And my challenge to you as COOs out there, in your sector, what is your relationship to mental ill health? What is it? Are you intolerant and you see people like me as a snowflake who can't take the heat in the kitchen and get things done? And when the pressure gets too much, I crumble? Or do you have a compassionate relationship to mental ill health? And the reason that decision to talk about my illness saved my life is, you know, I had to take 3 months off work. 3 months. There's no ways I could be at work. I was so anxious. I had no cognitive abilities left. I couldn't read a document and remember what I'd read. I couldn't look at some data and analyze it and make a good judgment. My cognitive abilities were impaired because of the anxiety that I was feeling. And I had dark moments during my recovery, very dark moments, moments when I didn't think life was worth living. I was probably going to be better off out of this world. My family would be better off. I wouldn't be a burden to everybody. But the only thing that kept me alive in my darkest, darkest moments was what I got back from everybody who knew about my illness, my family, some close friends, and some of my colleagues at work. And do you know what they gave me? They gave me the most wonderful outpouring of the most powerful emotion in the world. Do you know what it's called? It's called love. How many songs have been sung about the power of love? Jennifer Rush, The Power of Love. Do you know I get goosebumps every time I hear that song? Because in my darkest moments, just knowing that I had a 10-year-old who loved me, I had a line manager who loved me, I had a wife who loved me. And the second emotion was an emotion of hope. I used to meet with a colleague of mine every 10 days who 2 years prior to my illness had been so sick that he'd been admitted to the Priory here in the UK, a mental health hospital. And I used to meet with Martin every 10 days and I saw he was better. Do you know what he gave me? He gave me hope. He just gave me that little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. And so a combination of feeling loved, a sense of hope. And then, yes, I took medication, cognitive behavioral therapy, slowly getting back onto my bicycle. And you know what? I started this talk today by saying we're all unique individuals. We're all different. And what works for me doesn't work for everybody. But I know what can work for everyone who might be struggling is a sense of hope and just feeling that they are loved. And so over a period of 3 months, I get myself better. I re-enter Unilever. 2010, I have a bit of a relapse. Nothing as bad as that. I didn't have to take time off work in 2010. And then in October of 2012, I'm leaving Unilever House on Victoria Embankment here in London. And I'm walking over Blackfriars Bridge down to Waterloo Station. And I'm on the bridge. And my phone goes. And at the end of the phone is my wife. And she said, Jeff, where are you? I said, I'm on the bridge walking to the station. She said, please, can you get home as quickly as possible? I said, why? She said, I've got tragic, tragic news. You can imagine the first question I asked, are the girls okay? She said, yes, the girls are all right. But one of your closest friends died by suicide this afternoon. I think it was Carl Jung who once said, the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. The brighter the light, the darker the shadow. Robin Williams, Stephen Fry, Winston Churchill, Abraham Lincoln. And you know, my friend, that was him. He was the most fun-loving, compassionate, energetic human being. And now he was gone. And I got home that night. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, I am not an expert on mental health. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a therapist. In fact, I did a degree and a postgraduate degree in zoology. How I ended up in HR, I don't know. But I'm not an expert. I'm just somebody who's had some lived experience. And I lay in bed that night and I came to two very simple conclusions. The first conclusion I came to was, here I was in 2012, 4 years after my crucible moment in life. In many ways, flourishing. Why? Because I dedicate 60 to 90 minutes every single day to the most valuable asset that I have, which is my well-being. And I practice every single day dedicating those 60 minutes to maintaining my well-being. Nothing is more important. Not my wife, not my daughters, not my job. Nothing is more important. And I've got to do it because I am somebody who is susceptible to anxiety-fueled depression. So it is part of me maintaining my recovery. And here I am flourishing and my friend is dead. And I thought, what's the difference? And I came to a simple conclusion. I've been able to ask for help. I'd been able to have a conversation. I'd been able to see a doctor. He couldn't. He was an alpha male Afrikaner South African. There's no ways he could have that conversation. No ways. That wasn't part of the stereotype. That wasn't part of the male stereotype. And instead, he died by suicide. And the second conclusion I came to was that stigma had just killed my friend. Stigma. The stigma surrounding mental ill health had just killed my friend. And I lay there and I thought, that's not fair. I've got to do something about this. That is not fair. I've got to do something about it. But I didn't know where to start. I'm a South African living down in Surrey in the UK. Guess what? All my mates are a bunch of South Africans, you know, birds of a feather. We all flock together. And at the time, I've got a global Unilever network, bunch of people. You know what it's like when you work for large organizations for a long time. The only people you know are the people inside of Unilever. And I have this global network, but not a strong UK network. And I thought, how am I going to make a contribution starting in the UK? But back in 2012, here in the UK, we were just about a year into a big national campaign called Time to Change. And there was a very influential individual who was a patron to the campaign. He was also fronting part of the campaign. And so I Googled him that night and up came his website and the bottom right-hand corner was an email address. And so I wrote to him that night because I just knew if I could meet with him, he would open some doors and introduce me to some people. His name was Alistair Campbell. And for those of you who aren't UK-based, he used to be Tony Blair's communications director while Blair was in office. And this is Jeff MacDonald at btinternet.com writing to Alistair Campbell. This is not Tony Blair writing to Alistair Campbell. Within 10 minutes, I get a response. Within 10 minutes, I get a response from him. And my request to him was just to meet. Why? Because I'd had my crucible moment in life and I just lost a friend that afternoon and I wanted to do something about it. And he was starting to, and I wanted to do something. Within 10 minutes, I had a response. A week later, we met up in a small little village called Belsize Park, which is in North London. And ever since that day, November of 2012, Alistair began to introduce me to people. He opened some doors, which allowed me to take tiny, tiny footsteps on a journey filled with a deep sense of purpose. And that is to create workplaces all over the world where, as I speak to you today, there are billions and billions of people, not millions, not thousands, there are billions of people all over the world suffering in silence. There are people on this call. And I just want to give them the chance to be able to put their hand up and ask for some help. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not saying to you for 1 minute today, had my friend been able to have that one conversation, he would definitely be alive today. I'm not saying that for 1 minute. I cannot say that. But do you know what I can say? Had he been able to have just one conversation, there's a tiny chance. Think of a grain of sand. There's a tiny chance that he would be alive today. Tiny. And do you know, ladies and gentlemen, that is worth fighting for every single day of my life. It is worth fighting for giving those individuals who are struggling right now that tiny chance. Because that one conversation might just lead on a road to recovery and flourishing. So that's why I'm so passionate about trying to create not only workplaces, friendship groups, families. My friend couldn't even talk to his wife. I then co-led a piece of work in Unilever for 2 years as part of my role in addressing the stigma of mental ill health. And at the end of 2014, I left Unilever to go out into the world and live this life of purpose. And as I've journeyed that path over the last 8 years, and somebody once said, having a sense of purpose in your life will take you to people and to places you could never imagine. Having a sense of purpose will take you to people and to places you could never imagine. I saw it happen in Unilever. That organization has transformed itself in a way you could never imagine. It's happened to me. And as I've traveled that journey, I've worked in different sectors and in different parts of the world. And depending upon which part of the world I'm in, the degree of stigma varies. So if I'm in the UK, we're beginning to do some good work in organizations around addressing stigma. If I'm in Mumbai, I've got a lot of work still to do in addressing the stigma of mental ill health. And so what have I learned? And I talk to you as COOs of organizations, as people who have influence, who have influence. What are you doing in your organization to create a truly psychologically safe place? What are you doing? And there are a couple of lessons that I've learned of what I think workplaces should be doing to address the stigma of mental ill health. The first is to invest in some training. Do you know, I often say we spend billions in health and safety. Guess what? It all goes to safety. It all goes to keeping people physically safe at work. Why don't you want to keep people emotionally and mentally safe at work? I don't leave my emotions and my cognitive ability at the door when I walk in. But why are you so intent in just keeping me physically safe? Why don't you want to keep me emotionally and mentally safe so that I've got the energy to perform at my best? My well-being, my health is the most critical enabler to my performance. And I call it energy. Do you know the most limiting resource I see in workplaces today is the energy of people. They are frazzled. They can't wait for a Friday afternoon and they detest a Monday morning. They are frazzled. Yet energy, I think, is the most important enabler of performance. You know, when you're getting down to doing an interview, you've got the last two candidates. They've got all the same credentials. You choose the person who's got passion, the right attitude, who's going to bring energy to the place. When you're watching a football team, two football teams, or I don't know, two hockey teams, they've got the same skills, same knowledge, same experience. The team with the most energy and passion on the day will win it. They're the most hungry to win. And you know where we get our energy from? We get our energy from our well-being. We cannot be energized if we are not healthy. And so if it's such a critical enabler of individual, team, and organizational performance, my challenge to you today is, why is the health of your people not a strategic priority? Because I bet you in every one of your organizations, every strategic priority that you have is about enabling the performance of that organization. Why is well-being not there? And so if you're going to invest, if you're going to break the stigma of mental ill health, we need to train everyone, not just a couple of mental health first aiders. Everybody. We do it for safety. Let's do it for mental health. And I'm not talking about a two-day or a one-day program. I'm talking about 90 minutes of just raising the levels of awareness and understanding. What's depression? What's stress? What are the symptoms to look out for? How do we have a conversation? Training, training, training. The more people we get trained, the greater the understanding, the greater the degree of empathy, and eventually some compassion. First thing we've got to do. Secondly, let's run some awareness campaigns within your organization around mental health. Run some campaigns, 2 or 3 campaigns a year. And decide the language you want to use when it comes to mental health. Brand mental health is the most damaged brand I've ever come across. Jeepers, it's damaged. Whenever the person, anybody who uses the word mental health, you immediately go to illness, depression, anxiety, bipolar, psychosis. When I use the word physical health, people don't immediately go to cancer or glandular fever. If I walk into a Nike store or an Adidas store, what do I see all over the world? I see chiseled whippets, people with beautiful bodies. And I look at my own body and I think, jeepers, that body, I'd love a body like that. I feel inspired and I go and buy a pair of running shoes. What are the images we see around mental health? Jeff McDonald with his hand in his head, some black and white photograph, some guy in a mental asylum with a white coat on. What is inspirational and aspirational about maintaining our mental health? And so can we start to run campaigns in organizations where we begin to talk about the positive aspects of mental health? It's a wonderful thing to have mental health. I can think clearly when I've got mental health. I've got good cognitive abilities. I can analyze data and make good judgments. It's a wonderful thing to have. And so raising the awareness through campaigns across your organization is so, so important. And the third thing, and I'll come back to this, is telling stories. We've all got a story. And you know, in my experience in Unilever, the most powerful lever in beginning to normalize this conversation, the most powerful lever was being able and encouraging storytelling. Storytelling. But storytelling from people that the audience can resonate with. A shift manager to operators. A CEO to the management team. So those are just some of the lessons that I've learned in beginning to slowly address the stigma of mental ill health in workplaces. But you know, none of you on this call today has to wait for your organization to do anything. I would love you to join me on my crusade. Such influential people. I'd love you to join me on my crusade. And in order to join me on my crusade, I would ask you to just do 3 things. 3 things. The first, reflect on your relationship to mental ill health. What is it? Is it a relationship of intolerance or is it a relationship of compassion? And if you are intolerant, all I ask you to do is go and be curious. That's all I ask. Please go and be curious. Go and read. Go and talk to somebody who struggled. Please just go and be curious. The second thing I would ask you to do, I would ask you to just get the conversation going in your organization around mental health and mental ill health. Please just get the conversation going. Because I honestly believe if you can just catalyze and have these conversations, anything will be possible. You'll work out what is the best approach and the best way to create a psychologically safe place to work. If you can just have the conversation. Do you know John F. Kennedy once had a conversation about putting a man on the moon and bringing him back safely? One conversation. Guess what? It happened from one conversation. And the third thing I would ask you to consider doing is when you're ready, Please tell your story. Because we've all got a story. We've all got a story. Now, not all of us have got a story like mine. But we've all got a story. We know a friend, a loved one, a father, a mother. And if you're going to tell the story of somebody else, please get their permission first. Please get their permission first. Because we still live in a world of stigma. But let me give you an example of how powerful this can be, telling a story of somebody else. In Unilever, as we began to encourage storytelling, our chief scientist, a guy by the name of David Blanchard, he came in one day and he wrote a blog to his 3,000 scientists all over the Unilever world. And his blog was entitled, "What is it like to be the father of a daughter who suffers from general anxiety disorder?" He got his daughter's permission to write the blog. And then he wrote it. Do you know that the scientist in Bangalore, the scientist in Sao Paulo, when they read that blog, they knew they had a boss who had a compassionate and an understanding relationship. We've all got a story. And when you feel coached, when you feel it's psychologically safe, please tell your story. Please tell your story. Because every story that we tell is like sending a lifeboat out into the ocean, and the billions and billions of people who are suffering in silence as I talk to you right now, when they hear the story, they see the lifeboat and they cling on to it. And they cling on to it and they realize two things. The first thing they realize is they're not alone. And the second thing they realize is they are just normal. They are just normal, like me. They're just normal. I want to end with one last point, and that is, as I said to you, the most important priority in my life is my health. And I honestly believe that organizations today, if they could take more accountability to prevent people from getting ill in the first place, to enhance people's lives by seeing the health of their people as a strategic priority. I think that is absolutely critical. But as leaders, you will never, ever care for the health of anybody unless you care for your own health. It starts with us. If I don't care for my own well-being, I will not care for anybody else's well-being. And so my challenge to you today is, what are you doing to care for yourself, to care for the most valuable asset that you have? I think it was an air steward who once said, you know, during a safety briefing, if this airplane goes down and your daughter's sitting next to you, who do you put the oxygen mask on first? You put it on yourself first. And then you put it on your daughter. Where is your oxygen mask? Where is your oxygen mask? And you know, my oxygen mask is made up of a very simple acronym that I'm going to leave you with. If you've got a pen and paper, and I dedicate 60 minutes every single day to maintain my recovery, to prevent myself from falling back into where I was. And I made 60 minutes dedicated to this acronym. But I can give you the acronym. But if your health and your well-being is not a priority in your life, you might try it out for a couple of days and then you'll go back to the old. And so my challenge today is shifting the mindset of, where is that oxygen mask? Is it on everybody else, or is it on yourself first? And if it's on yourself first, I'm going to leave you with a simple acronym. It's called CANDO. The C in CANDO stands for connection. I will dedicate 15 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes every day to connect. Connection is such an important driver of our emotional health. Connect with a friend, a member of family, connect with nature. It's such an important driver of our emotional health. And part of why we have felt so anxious, sad, depressed during COVID times is because those social connections have been disrupted hugely. And so connection is so important. The A in CANDO stands for just be active. Take a bit of time out every single day. Go for a walk. Go for a run. Go for a jog. But just dedicate a bit of time every day to be active. The N in can do stands for just try and be nice to someone every day. Just try and be nice. See what that does to your sense of purpose and meaning. It was Plato who once said, just be kind to everybody you meet because we're all fighting a harder battle. The D in can do stands for discover. Be curious. Learn something new every day. Take 10 minutes, 15 minutes, listen to a podcast. Read a book, learn a new skill. But just take 10 or 15 minutes every day to just oil those neural pathways by being curious and learning something new. So good for our mental health. And then finally, the O. The O in can do stands for observe. It's called recovery. Every 2 hours, take a 5-minute recovery break. Just 5 minutes to recover every 2 hours. And what do I mean by that? Switch your laptop off, switch your phone off, grab a cup of coffee, stand in the daylight, listen to some music, but just take a 5-minute recovery break. And you know, I chunk can do up into 60 to 90 minutes every single day. Why? Because it's the most valuable asset I have in my life, my health. I will end on a quote. Make time for your wellness, because if you don't, you might one day be forced to make time for your illness. Thank you.
No, that was brilliant, Jeff. Thank you so much. There was a lot to take in. The can do will certainly be something I'll carry forward. Can I just ask you, though, Jeff, if you said, you know, one of the things you said was because of you were so lucky because you had this the experience, you had a compassionate leader and you had your personality, you're gregarious. What if you haven't got quite the basis you have? What if you're coming from somewhere where you don't quite have the experience, you're a bit of an introvert? What's your first protocol? What do you do? How do you start recognizing and knowing you need to put yourself first?
Well, I mean, you know, putting yourself first, how do we know whether we should put ourselves first? I mean, I hope it doesn't take everybody in the world to have a crucible moment like I had to realize the importance of our health, our well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it's also, you know, it's around education. You know, when I grew up, I was kind of taught the importance of keeping myself physically healthy, which is quite good. But nobody ever taught me about how do I keep myself emotionally and mentally healthy. And if I'm an introvert and I notice some, you know, the other thing is self-awareness, Miriam. Self-awareness. We were never taught how to be self-aware, how to get in touch with our emotions and how we're feeling. I wish somebody had taught me some of that stuff. You know, there were signs that I was getting ill. I just didn't see them or maybe didn't want to see them. There were signs. As I said to you, some of those things the doctor asked me, those were things that were going on for 3 or 4 weeks before I had that panic attack. And for the introvert out there, you know, all I would say, I think it was Charles Mackesy who said, Miriam, he said, asking for help is not giving up. It's refusing to give up. It's refusing to give up. And so for the introverts out there who might be feeling they haven't got the personality that Jeff is, not able to just kind of do compartmentalized stuff, do mask things, very introverted, there's a simple step. If you're noticing some of these things, your normal behavior is just not normal. You're just not your usual self. And it's persisted for 3 or 4 weeks. Simply pick up the phone and go and talk to a doctor. Just go and have a conversation with your doctor. And you don't have to be an extrovert or an introvert to be able to do that.
Yeah, we just had, actually, just on that, Jeff, on the chat, someone said, can you share some of the pre-attack warning signs?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was stuff that I was talking about earlier. My levels of irritability had gone through the roof. 3 or 4 weeks, I mean, the smallest little things used to just irritate me. I just got so irritated by stuff. My sleep had become completely disrupted. I was sleeping badly. I'd wake up, I'd be anxious, waking up 2 o'clock in the morning, can't go back to sleep. Now, look, we all have nights like that, and sometimes we have a week like that. But you know what? If those sorts of things persist for 4 or 5 weeks, something's going on. The fact that I couldn't eat breakfast because I'd wake up feeling so anxious, I didn't want lunch, so I was losing weight. The fact that I didn't want to do the things that I normally liked doing, that I enjoyed doing, that I just didn't have the energy and desire to do them. And you know, I'm different. I'm unique. We're all different. And so what the triggers for me are different for others. But what I would say, Miriam, is what you've got to do is we all know our own normal behavior. And you all know the normal behavior of the people you lead as well. And you know, if you notice a change in your normal behavior, how you normally are, both you as an individual, as well as the people that you might be leading, you've just noticed a particular individual's normal behavior, and that normal behavior is not normal, and it's persisted for 4 or 5 weeks, it's worth a conversation. It's worth a phone call.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think, Jeff, there's almost a need to, you know, rebrand mental health and put it just under health? So it's physical, it's mental, it's all together. And then
my problem with the word health, Miriam, is that people just go to physical health.
Yeah.
So I do like the word well-being. But I know that most CFOs roll their eyes when we talk about well-being, all right? They just, what's this fluffy well-being stuff? Well, I'm sorry, it's not so fluffy. No. Because when I had no well-being, I had no energy and I couldn't perform. I had all the knowledge, I had all the skills, I had all the behaviors, I had all the experience. So there's nothing fluffy about it. But why I like the word well-being is because it's a more holistic description of our health. It entails our physical health, our mental health, our emotional health. So it's just a more holistic description. But at the end of the day, it's about that energy. And when we are healthy, when we've got good well-being, we are energized. And you know what? When I'm energized, I can move mountains. I can move mountains. You know, I get quite annoyed in organizations. We have engagement surveys. And they're great things to have. But you know what they measure? They measure your willingness to go the extra mile. They don't measure your capacity to go the extra mile, your capacity, your ableness to go the extra mile. And in engagement surveys, we have two questions about well-being. Does this company care for your well-being? Do your line managers do? Two questions. Come on. Come on. Why are we so good at safety? Because we have measures. We treasure what we measure. And you know, today, we can survey our employees' well-being. But what I find is that lots of senior leaders don't want to see that data. They're too scared. They're too scared. And I think it's part of people like me who I think we need to support. We need to help leaders. We need to let them know that there are ways and there are things out there that can enhance the well-being of people and therefore the performance of the organization.
Mm. What if you had someone who you can see the signs, yet they don't acknowledge them? So it could be family, colleagues.
Yeah. You know, Miriam, on that one, I often get asked that question.
Yeah.
I start by saying the following. Unless you think that person might harm themselves, you've got no place in intervening. If you think they might harm themselves, you've got to intervene. Phone 911 and get an ambulance to see that person. But if you don't think that they are going to harm themselves, you can't take responsibility for their actions. I often say you take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. Mm-hmm. You know what you can do, Miriam, is you can give it a lot of salt. It might want to drink. And so if you are noticing somebody and they are, I think what you've got to do is you've got to go into that conversation with three things in mind. The first is I want to express some of my own vulnerability in that conversation. I want to start by being vulnerable myself. Don't go into that conversation as some macho kind of pointing out. Go into that conversation being vulnerable, expressing some of your own vulnerabilities. Go into that conversation with some data. What do I mean by that? I've noticed this. I've noticed that. I've noticed this over the last 4 or 5 weeks. Are you sure you're okay? How are you sleeping? How are you feeling? Instead of asking people, are you okay? Why don't we ask people, how are you feeling? Why don't we ask people, how are you sleeping? That might ignite a completely different conversation than, how are you? And then bring some of the data, the things that you've noticed. And then the third thing, Miriam, is just be there to be that active listener. You know, I often say, I can't always be happy. I can't always be content. But you know what I can always appreciate? Somebody who listens to me. Somebody who just listens to me. It can be so empowering. And then finally, you might signpost them But at the end of the day, you have to leave them to make the decision. You cannot take responsibility for their decision. They are adults. But what you can do is you can show love. You can bring hope. You can signpost. You can actively listen. You can be vulnerable. But you can't take responsibility for their decisions.
No, it's the one thing. We can outsource lots of things, but we can't outsource our physical or our mental health.
Absolutely.
Got to take accountability. And as you say, showing compassion, showing love, and hopefully injecting a little bit of hope is a good start.
That for me is the silver lining of COVID. I've just seen during COVID that we started to come together again. We started to show compassion to one another. We started to be concerned about the well-being of our employees. The only thing I'm sad about is that it took a virus like that.
But you're right, it is a silver lining.
It says, he has a question. Be it talking to a friend, discussing with, what's this? It's from Sachin. Empathy, understanding, direct. Yeah, absolutely. Be it talking to a friend, discussing with a manager, counseling or professional help. Absolutely, Sachin. Thank you.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes, yeah. I am.
Sorry, I'm not sure if this is allowed, but I thought I'd give it a shot. I'm someone that's had really bad anxiety, really bad stress. But now I'm in a position where, because I'm managing it better, I've also been able to help people within my organization to, who are going through the same thing. And you're completely right about showing yourself to be vulnerable and letting them know that when appropriate, you've been through the same things that they might be going through. But the key thing for me is to get, as you said, get that understanding of what they're going through, but be able to direct them to people that can help them better if that's what they need. So you can say, I'm always here for as a shoulder to cry on, but there are professional services that might help, and there's absolutely no stigma attached to trying to them. Why would you, as you said, you would go to the doctor if you had a broken leg?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you go to see a professional if you just needed to, you know, to have some counseling, to talk it out, to get some professional help about how to manage your anxiety, stress, depression, etc. So
yeah,
that's all I was trying to say from a position of experience.
Thank you.
No, that's great, because we accommodate. If you came in with a cast on your arm and you were trying, you know, you were a secretary role and you'd lost, we would accommodate, but we don't have the same thing around the mental health issues. But it's great to know that you're there for people.
Just a little bit. I know there's a lot of COOs on this course, right? Last thing, the first thing I did when someone needed the help, a lot of the time the mental health support in organizations is hidden. So the first thing, send an email out that says, these are the professional services you can talk to, this is who you can call, this is what's covered under your health plan, that kind of thing. And it's such a huge help, because at that point you don't even need to be able to notice what your staff are doing. They have the tools they need to actually get that help themselves without anyone knowing about it. But a lot of the time that data is hidden.
Thank you for that. That'll be the final. We're actually just coming up to the hour, so I'm afraid that we're going to take over any more time. Thank you all so very much for your input. Thank you, a huge thank you, Jeff. That was an absolutely wonderful, wonderful keynote on mental health and well-being. I'm sure you all got some food for thought on that. And just remember, if nothing else, love, hope, compassion, and put on your own oxygen mask first, so you're a better place to help others. Again, massive thank you, Jeff. What an inspirational talk and what an inspirational speaker. Thank you, Charlotte, in the background, who runs everything for me virtually. Have a wonderful rest of the day. If you've got any feedback, any thoughts, any queries, please do not hesitate to contact us. That's what we're here for. Thanks again, Jeff. Thank you, everyone. Take care. Bye.